So it is my pleasure today to introduce Paul Pangara. So he's a professor of the practice of design here at the School of Computer Science, particularly in the department Human-Computer Interaction Institute. And he's had a long, successful career in the field of HCI, starting at its early beginnings in the MIT architecture group in the 1980s, and has a career spanning both industry and academia. He's moved in and out based off his interest in research. And today he's going to talk about designing ethical interfaces and where he's come to see what designers should be doing at the user interface in order to start to address questions that we've been thinking about for ethics.
Great, Kristen. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming, everybody. I should preface this as saying it might be an unusual kind of talk for this series, because I'm not coming with my own definitions of ethical behavior. I'm going to assume you kind of know that, and also that the world of AI and all of its complexities and the issues of bias and so on are there. My goal as a practitioner, literally, is to offer to my community ways of designing. I'm trying to be very specific about that. So we might hold high notions of what's good and bad for individuals and society, and we might carry those around and hope for having those values in our actions every day, but I'm trying to be much more pragmatic. It's kind of who I am and who I've been. My hope is that I will learn from this, from interacting with this group and others like it around the campus. And as I was saying to Kristen, there's a lot of talk inside of HCII, the department I'm in, about the importance of ethics. That's understood and given. The question is, how do we then carry that to the students? And this is still an open question. Let me begin by telling you my bias. My bias is to try to start with an organizing principle, because I think they're powerful, and I think they're guiding. And I will walk through this particular one. I shall act always so as to increase the total number of choices. Now, what does this mean? What is a choice, for example? I have to make the clear distinction. This is not options. I have 1,000 options for talking about what's in this room or deciding where I might sit in this room. But I'm not going to sit on the trash can. That's not a choice for me. It's an option, but it's not a choice. So by choice in this is meant, what is something viable that I might actually want to do now? Now, why does it begin with I shall act? Well, I shall is very different than thou shalt, which we're used to in various moral situations. So if I tell you what you should do, thou shalt behave, thou shalt not, commandments and so on, there's a long history of these things. What happens when I do that is I stand apart from you and I say, I tell you what to do. This feels to me at best inappropriate. The reverse of that, in a sense, is to instead stand as part of the world and as responsible for my actions in the world and tell you what I will do and the values that I hold and that determine my actions or influence my actions, rather than telling you what you should do. Hence this statement from Heinz von Forster, who's a very influential man in the world of cybernetics, not AI and robotics, but this science and discipline of systems that have purpose, began in the 40s, yada, 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 stories for another time. And in the context of understanding systems that have goals and act to achieve their goals, von Forster was incredibly clear, as his wife Mai used to like to say, Heinz has a mind like a crystal, and he would come forward with statements like this and then explain them in beautiful ways. In addition, Heinz called this an ethical imperative. Those of you who know philosophy probably better than I do will know that imperatives are in that history beyond the scope of our discussion today, but the idea that it is imperative if I choose to act ethically that I act to increase the total number of choices. Now, why am I here? Why am I talking about this? We can impose the ethical imperative in our everyday lives. I could choose to increase my options, or rather my choices. See, I fell into that trap. or I could help others increase their choices. And of course, if I'm a designer, that, I feel, is the ethical imperative of designers. This is a proposal I'm making. That designers actually increase choices for others. Now, we could go down the rabbit hole of, wait a minute, you have an interface and it's an app on your phone and there are three choices and, you know, you can't give them 1,000 choices, on and on and on. Issues of personalization, recommendation engines, and so on. Happy to talk about those. Don't bite my finger. Please continue to look where I'm pointing. My point is that if I begin from this, that I can interpret it in a way that is useful for interaction designers. This is the world I've lived in even before that was a word, a phrase. So I want to present a couple of quandaries, a couple of situations that are not clear and awkward, and to bring forward Heinz von Forster's idea of an ethical imperative as interpreted from the lens of a designer. So here is ethical quandary number one. We all know about recommendation engines, right? My complaint about recommendation engines is that they're based on who I was, not who I am right now in the moment. Think about it, right? It's my entire history is being used, for better or worse, privacy busting or not, to determine what I might do next. But if it determines what I'm going to do, it's made a recommendation that I may choose, then that's based on who I was. And I don't think it has to be that way. Because at worst, this presumes a non-evolving, non-living user, right? It means that I'm the same as I was a minute ago, 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago. Work with me here. So my feeling is that this is regulating and regurgitating mostly what I've done before, maybe stretching it a little bit if it's sophisticated, but you all know the phrase filter bubble and so on. I want an interface that acts to increase my total number of choices. Recommendation engines have this quandary, as I call it. Search engines are similar because the results come based on who I was, who I have been. Now, there are a whole lot of signals. You know, Google talks about 200 signals in determining what the ranking is, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that's based on some giant aggregate of things and to some extent about me. But I want to be controversial about this. I want to say that search results are of the past and therefore they're dead on arrival. Answers are dead. Answers are dead. Questions are alive. Questions are of the now. And questions constitute a potential path of what I may become in which I have a participation. If you're telling me, here's the best thing for you, Paul, then you've pretty much figured that out for me. I don't have agency in it. So as conscious creatures, of course, we live in the now. And wouldn't we rather define our own future, our own becoming? So to summarize this, recommendation engines and search results are based on the past, treating us as we used to be, as if we were dead. And of course, questions are alive, questions are of the now. How would we make an interface that would allow me to be alive in that moment, in that interaction? So how do we treat users as alive and interacting? I have a few proposals. One is to build question engines. Instead of a search engine that gives me what it thinks of as an answer, which, by the way, causes me to think that I have the answer and I'm done and I don't have to integrate it into what I know and I don't necessarily even have to think about it very much. I just accept it. I don't have to think about it critically. Younger students have this issue, right? They go to Google and they get the answer. I'm done. Now I know it. This is a danger. So can I build a question engine that computes questions that invite a generative conversation, such that novel and forward-seeing choices may be explored? I believe I can build this. I have some ideas. Don't have research money yet, one of the few ideas that you'll hear today. But the concept of a question engine, something that gives me good questions, we all know what it's like to have a colleague who asks you a really fabulous question about what you just told them. And we know the value of that. So could we make a question engine instead? Now, interface quandary number two, I have to demonstrate in terms of a parable that I call the parable of Luigi's pizza. And now I need someone to be willing to play with me on this, and willing, trigger warning, willing to be shocked. Okay? Anyone willing to be shocked? Yes, no? Kristen, can I? They're not volunteering. Great. So Kristen, please, ask me where there's good pizza. Kristen, the best pizza is Luigi's Pizza right across the street. Now ask me, why is that good pizza? Why is it the best?
Why is it the best pizza?
Screw you, I'm not going to tell you that. I just described Google, right? Google tells you what's ranked number one, and it doesn't tell you why. Now you're going to say, oh yes it does. There are 200 signals. It uses reviews and Yelp and what you've done before and what other people have done. Yeah, but it doesn't tell you that. And it doesn't let you ask, why is it good, right? It gives you these generic big data answers, big vague things. We'll come back to that. Why do we accept from a machine something that we would never accept from a human being? If I really did that to Kristen, she'd never talk to me again. And rightly so, because we don't want to be treated that way. And yet we accept it from our machines. So what's the response to this? Can we give users agency that is equal to the algorithm? For example, can we create a dialogical interface so that a user can question the computed offering, the recommendation, and no matter what comes at us from the machine, we could ask questions like, why'd you recommend that? Where'd that result come from? Did you consider whether they use sustainable sourcing? Did you consider that they bring the food to the table when it's still hot? Can I bring my values to that exchange such that what I think of as important can be brought into the conversation and I can get a recommendation based on my values, not based on their opaque values? Third idea is, can we guide users to the conversations that are valuable? I mean, when you have a good conversation, you say, wow, that was a great conversation. That was really good. I like that, right? This happens all the time. So we have a kind of intuitive sense of it. Can we build a heuristic that would look at conversations in Slack channels or conversations in social media or anywhere that conversations take place, text exchanges, voice exchanges, an interview on YouTube of what's going on? And can we have a machine tell us what's interesting? This is an interesting twist, I think. So we all know the Turing test, which is, can a human tell if a machine is intelligent? I want a machine that'll tell me if a conversation is intelligent. And think about what you would save by having a heuristic that would look at myriad conversations and draw your attention to the important part. Now, this is being done now in real-world situations such as doctor-patient conversations, where there's a company, it's a seeming spin-off, you may have heard of it, that listens to the verbal exchange, transcribes it, and then says to the doctor afterwards, oh yeah, you know this part here where they're talking about medication and their reaction to it? Put that in the patient's medical record. That's great. Of course, it could also say, you know, you asked the patient the question and you didn't get an answer and you kept going. And you could also tell the doctor, you know, you ignored entirely everything they said about how bad they feel. So it could even become a coach. So these are very pragmatic ways in which, but I want the general case. I want to wake up in the morning and not read my social media feed. I want something like this to tell me where to look. And instead of the Turing test, I want to call it a turning test, right? A little pun. Conversational turns back and forth. So for me, these become research questions. And the third one I'm actually looking for funding for, and I'm working with a colleague here in the School of Computer Science on that. Three areas for design research. Now, where am I going with this? Well, much as all roads lead to Rome, in that old cliche, for me, all interfaces lead to conversation. Because with real conversation, participants have the agency to direct it in different directions, to ask questions, to agree to disagree, to agree to disagree, to generate options, and to explore choices. So for me, conversation is the fundamental way of increasing the number of choices, of following the ethical imperative, which is to act always to increase. I don't have time to describe conversation in detail. I'm going to do a kind of quick review of how I think of it and the history that I'm coming out of, the tradition really that it's coming out of. When I say conversation, though, I need to add a caveat. What I mean, and I'll give you some definitions in a minute. Whenever I say conversation, don't just think of this or think of this. Think of me thinking about something that I've never read before. Oh, that's interesting. How does that compare to what I used to think? Oh, that's fascinating. You know what? I think I disagree with that. That's a conversation. It's a conversation if I walk over here and say, wow, Paul, would you like some pizza? You know, you had a late breakfast and might give you indigestion. Yeah, but it's going to be really tasty. Yeah, you know, last time you had indigestion. That's a conversation. So any kind of learning requires that. So how do we get better at interaction design? I propose looking at human conversation, creating interfaces that are cooperative, ethical, and humane, and I'll define those shortly, and push for new forms of conversational interface. So you all use Siri or Alexa or Cortana or Bixby or whatever else is the conversational interface du jour, and they all stink, right? They're all stupid. I would like to change that, and I believe this is a way forward. First of all, I think we have to say what conversation is. And I'm going to give you an oversimplified model that's ideal and pristine and doesn't show the messiness. And this is a 60-second version of what could be a 10-minute version. But one way to break it down is to say conversation begins from a context, this vertical line labeled at the bottom, which is where the conversation happens. It's not just time and place, but it's situation. So if we have a conversation here, it's a university, it's a big room, there's a lecture, blah, blah, blah. There's always a context and a situation involved. It has to start in a language that is comprehensible enough to both sides, such that both sides stays, easy to say, obvious. But in the process of the engagement, new ideas may emerge, new definitions. I might learn things from you that I never knew before. And ultimately, we may come to a kind of agreement. Yeah, I like that idea, or no, I don't want to do that project with you. Or in the process of starting this new company, I believe the ethical way forward is not to have a business model that uses privacy. And ultimately, action or transaction, so we might agree then to go to dinner together, that's an agreement. We might do our project together, we might start a movement, etc. So it's a cute little acronym, CLEAT, where the idea is you get traction. So it's this kind of thing, and I'll deepen it later. What are the kinds of conversation you can have? Well, there are lots of kinds. A lot of them aren't very useful. But what's an effective conversation? It's a conversation in which something changes and brings, hopefully, lasting value to one or more participants. Now, what does changes mean? Many, many different kinds of things. And I think you all know the range of these things without me giving you a laundry list of examples. Why does it matter? Well, if we're going to do something together, we have to agree on it. If we're going to agree on it, we have to have an exchange. If we have an exchange, we have to start at least with a sufficiently shared language. So conversation matters because if we want to cooperate and collaborate, we have to talk. We have to have a conversation. Okay? I think it's controversy. What might follow from conversation? All kinds of things. These things require conversation. What does conversation enable? All these things. So you get the point. Conversation is pretty damn important because to do any of these in the list demands conversation. Now, the simplicity of this is misleading. This is not, you know, some silly cartoon. It's actually based on its cybernetic roots. I use that term with some trepidation because cybernetics is often interpreted as robotics and AI or as feedback loops. And certainly feedback loops are involved, loops upon loops. And there's a much deeper technicality, I don't want to call it a mechanics. Some people accuse cybernetics as being mechanical. That just means they don't really know it. Sorry, don't mean to sound dismissive. And this is a very serious, formal set of mechanisms. Again, a kind of ideal way of how it works. What I'm drawing on in particular is a diagram from a particular guy who, his name is Gordon Pask, who wrote a series of books on conversation and did a lot of studies over decades with people, with machine research situations and experiments, and ultimately developed a theory of conversation, part of which was published in this book. As Kristen alluded, I worked for a while at the Architecture and Machine Group at MIT. It was the predecessor group to the Media Lab, also started by Nicholas Negroponte. And when Nicholas edited a book, he asked Gordon Pask to write a text on machine intelligence. And it's, actually, let me go back. It gets pretty formal. He's referencing all of these people. I only underline the names that you would certainly know. Newell, of course, was here. Simon, of course, was here. Minsky Papert. If you know anything about the history of AI or CMU, you know these names. So Pask knew all these guys and referenced them heavily. But his own text is actually quite dense and formal. It's many pages long. It's not fooling around. And there's a lot of rigor in it in the context of understanding what conversation is and how it works. Again, my job today is not to go into detail, but to give you some sense that it's not a silly diagram with an infinite loop in red. It's much more sophisticated than that. The model on the left is that of an architecture machine, namely a computer that you could have a conversation with in the rich sense of conversation. And you could have that conversation about designing a piece of architecture, a building, space. And the important thing is that it's a conversation about possibilities. It's a conversation about goals. The machine here is not just giving you the thickness of the beam and a 3D rendering of the space in a fancy movie. It's actually kibitzing back and forth with you and arguing with you about what you think the space should do and how you would explore options and ultimately make choices for your final design. So this proposal is still out there. Nicholas abandoned it when he started the Media Lab. I think it's an unmet need and possibility. And to create a machine that would be more conversational for designers, I think is quite doable. Certainly more doable today than it was 40 years ago when Pask wrote this paper. So again, this diagram and this diagram and that diagram are all about the same phenomenon. But let's look at the implication of looking at conversation as goals and means. So let's say we're having a conversation with Alexa. One form of conversation is, hey Alexa, give me news from NPR. So that's saying my goal is to listen to news and I want you to get it through NPR. So it's controlling both the goals and the means. But that's not a very interesting conversation. That doesn't expand the possibilities for me. Another is what we call, informally, a guiding conversation, where I say, hey, I want to listen to the news, what do you got? Because I'm not sure I know all the options. I don't want to say NPR, I want to know what possibilities exist, because then I can make a better choice. Because I might learn of a choice that I didn't know before. Here's another form in which I say, hey, give me some news, and it goes ahead. Now here, of course, it gets a little bit tricky because I might end up being subjected to CNN or Wall Street Journal or Breitbart News or 8chan or Reddit or something that doesn't necessarily reflect my values. And if you think this isn't an issue, it is in cultures where they get what they get by way of news from WhatsApp. And usually, it's forwarded from somebody else, and usually the source is omitted. So imagine getting a text and it says, Pizzagate. You see where I'm going, right? It's telling you something that is pre-digested and has a point of view, but you don't know enough about the context in which that is given to you. So delegating has some perils, clearly. And the last in the sequence, although there are many, many more different intercombinations of this, is you decide together on goals. How about I listen to something? What do you got? Well, there's news, there's classical music, there's opera. Oh no, never opera, people often say to me. How about country and western? Maybe. The point there is that I may learn something if I'm A and I say, what do you got, that I didn't know before. So my horizon would be expanded as a consequence of a conversation in which it is not predetermined either by me controlling, play me NPR, or by me saying, play me any news, but rather understanding what the possibilities are. So these variations, I think, are powerful. And we teach them in these classes on conversational user interfaces to students as a way of blowing out their way of thinking about specifically conversation interfaces. Right? Makes sense? I think we all know what this is like. And how well does AI and today's conversation interfaces do these things? Scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the best. 2, 3, we could argue that. But let's go further. What's a great conversation? It tells you things you enjoy learning and delights you. Of course, you don't know ahead of time what it's going to be. Surprising, energizing. Goes places you didn't expect to go. Evolves in ways you couldn't evolve on your own. Now I think you're going to hear the echo of the ethical imperative. Can a designer create a conversational exchange, or the possibility for a conversational exchange, that has the features of a great conversation? I believe it can. And furthermore, I believe it should, because it's ethical to increase the number of choices for someone else rather than limit them. Now, I'm claiming, in a sense, that conversation is itself an interface, whether it's person to person, person to machine, machine to machine, and that something changes somewhere. Remember, an effective conversation is where we have some change. So I have three very specific intentions, and I'll define each one. So a cooperative interface is one where conversation is involved, and there's a sequence of coherent interactions back and forth that enable the evolution of a point of view such that understanding and agreement are ongoing. Kind of a tall order, but there's a level of cooperation here that I think is valuable to hope for, to allow an evolution of points of view, for example, rather than say, hi, these are your three choices. Which one do you want? Oh, no, you can't ask me about it. Oh, Luigi's Pizza? Yeah, it's the best. Screw you, I'm not going to tell you which one is best, why I'm saying which one is best. So this is one offer. Another offer is about ethical interfaces, and I realize I'm treading on other people's toes here. I would like an ethical interface when there is reliable transparency of action and intent, the what and the why. Luigi's Pizza, because gets great reviews, it's right across the street and near you, they do sustainable sourcing, they have gluten-free, because I know you've got a problem with that, Paul, et cetera, et cetera. Such that trust may build and be maintained. Now, this might be a little bit of a surprise, the Luigi's Pizza interface could tell you how it made the choices, but it might tell you by giving you 25 pages of stuff to read. So this is the terms and conditions and privacy policy problem, right? Where, oh, we're telling you what we're doing with your data. Oh, you want to use the site? Click here. Oh, you don't want to read the 25 pages ahead? That's okay, just click. You know all of these issues, right? So how do you get around that? The problem that it's unreasonable that it's asking you to read 25 pages. So I have an answer. It shouldn't surprise you. You could probably invent it for yourself right now. I think that a humane interface is one where any participant may influence the focus and flow. Where instead of saying, why is it good pizza, and it giving you 25 pages as to why it's good, you can interrupt. It's just like a friend is saying, well, blah, 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 blah. No, wait a second. Do they have gluten-free? Are they open now? It's 11 o'clock. Can you bring your interests and values to the conversation immediately, directly, and cause a focus, and thereby get the answer that you want in your terms, in your time? That's humane. And that is what allows collaboration. I think this can be put into every interface. And I think ethically it's the appropriate thing to do. So the summary is, I'm offering proposals, I would love pushback, of cooperative, ethical, and humane interfaces. And I think all of these put conversation at the heart of interaction design. And can we as designers enable conversations for others? Can we design for interactions that have these qualities? Ask great questions. Offer different ways for you to achieve your goal. Increase your choices. Collaborate with you to define your goals. New goals. Expand your choices. And help you be what you want to be, what you want to be or to become. Again, this comes back to the basic ethical imperative. And that's what I wanted to say today, and I hope it generates a conversation. Thanks very much.
I was just wondering, like, when